But you are giving away information about yourself with no... You don't see what the reward is going to be. And so why should you do that? It might backfire.
And they're even dangerous. Because it gives people who want to impersonate you with your credit card, etc. So basic decency.
So who are we to say that the lectures that we've given this week will not be given again next year, next week sometime in China by a different group of lecturers?
Well,
would we mind?
Indeed.
It might even be given better.
That's not...
Hi, you're my chair, aren't you? Good.
This keeps a string.
Yes, I'm ready when you're ready.
The only other place I know is there's an organisation called Boy Scouts.
I guess we should start this whistle conversation with Jeffrey Grimmett from Cambridge. And he will talk about on
It's very unusual for me to give a lecture in a conference, the title of which I do not understand at all. So I've been wondering how I can relate to the title. I think that's less important, of course, than relating to the audience. I have Wikipedia'd the title to see whether, in fact, I do know something about the title, but I think the answer is no. My research indicates that I don't know anything about any of the subjects which are indicated in the title. I mean, of course, in a sense, we all know something about mesoscopic systems, but it all depends what you mean by a mesoscopic system, and I'm not actually quite sure what that means. So I've interpreted my remit as a kind of after-dinner speaker. Now, after which dinner, you may ask? I mean, we're all after-dinner speakers, we hope. But I've decided to give a kind of general talk, but focus towards my own interests, because I think they're very interesting, on statistical physics associated with graphs. So my title, of course, well, lecture courses, books, volumes, encyclopedias can be written on the subject of lattice models in statistical physics, or whatever I called this this lecture. So naturally, I have to focus it somewhere. And it's not, you might say, focused in the direction of the overall program, which is called analysis on groups. I mean, of course, we all know something about analysis because we all have to do some analysis. It's a very broad subject. Analysis on graphs. Graphs, of course, suggest an interest in the graph itself. The only graphs in this talk are going to be lattices, so they're very regular graphs. They're graphs which contain circuits. That's very important. But at the same time, apart from circuits, they have enormous properties of regularity, which make them sensitive to study, but also makes them sort of first attack at modeling space-time. Now, why is there not more analysis in my talk? Well, perhaps the reason is because when I was an undergraduate, there was a misconception in what I did as an undergraduate. I chose probability theory, so I hope I will make you laugh, because it deserves to make you laugh. I chose probability theory because I didn't like analysis. Now, I realize, very gracious of you to laugh, I realize that this is a mistake, and in order to rectify this, I have, in the last 30-odd years, come to learn and use some analysis. There are other probabilists, of course, who took the same decision, who went the other direction. Now, one of the things that many of you have in common is the quantum word. So I want to get in my sort of quantum statement first. I didn't do quantum theory as an undergraduate. Of course, it was well known at the time that in order to get the top marks, you had to do quantum theory. And it's interestingly still true in Cambridge that the quantum courses give a large number of marks relative to other courses. So it seems to be that if you really want the top grade, the top mark in Oxford or Cambridge and many other universities, you have to do the quantum courses. I'm not quite sure what that means, but empirically, the students know this. Now, I didn't do the quantum courses, and I've never understood quantum theory, and I think this is my weakness. I fully acknowledge this. I cannot blame it upon my functional analysis supervisor at Oxford, who did an absolutely wonderful job, and is present in this room, by the way, if you hadn't guessed that already. Consequently, I've always felt disconnected from quantum theory, but I have recently started writing papers in quantum theory, so maybe this is a sort of convergence, in middle age, towards quantum theory. One sees these convergences as people become older. This is not to claim that I understand what I'm writing about, but I will tell you at the end of the lecture, and then you can quiz me to see to what degree I do understand what I'm writing about. I mean, I have come to understand that quantum theory is just the theory of operators on tensor products of Hilbert spaces. And seen from that point of view, even a mathematician can make some contribution. Now, this talk, in a sense, starts with the most basic statistical mechanical object that has received enormous study in the last 100 years, and that is, in a sense, it's the ESI model. Now, this book was published in, I think, 1973, McCoy Wu, and it's always interesting, of course, to read prefaces of books. They tell you something about, and this is one of the reasons why you have to be very careful when you write the preface of a book, because it may be the only part of your book that's read afterwards. In the preface, McCoy and Wu write, this is 73, remember, since the two-dimensional ESI model forms the basis of much of our theoretical understanding of phase transitions, it is unfortunate that these recent developments have not been easily accessible to the general community of physicists. And then he continues to talk, they continue to talk about the work of Onsager and Yang, the view that the ESI model, even in 73, was regarded as a totally closed and solved object. And they go on to talk about the Peter Castellane paper of 61, and they say, furthermore, even if one has the patience to trace the references back to Castellane's 1961 paper, the usual result is a feeling of confusion. This confusion arises not out of any errors in the published work, but out of the fact that in journal articles, many things must be omitted owing to lack of space. That's a very nice way of putting it. Therefore, points that can be straightened out and rigorously shown to cause no problems are often treated very briefly. The careful reader, therefore, has questions that he must resolve for himself, and the resolutions are frequently quite time-consuming. So that was written in 1973, and it's just as true today about the two-dimensional ESI model. A lot has been written in the meantime, but the two-dimensional ESI model continues to be a source of extremely beautiful problems for the physicists and for the mathematicians. And, of course, through the resurgence of SLE, through the creation, discovery of SLE in the last 5 years, the mathematicians have really brought something new to the two-dimensional ESI model, which threatens to produce a complete understanding, mathematical understanding of conformal field theory, or some aspects of conformal field theory. So this resurgence of interest in the two-dimensional ESI model is potentially enormously fruitful for our wider community. Now, I'm not actually quite sure, to go back to my monologue about who we are and why we're here, I'm not actually quite sure who we are. I remember yesterday's last speaker said on several occasions, I'm not a physicist. So perhaps we're a community of I'm not physicists, I'm not sure. I mean, in this room, anyway. In which case, we're obviously at home. So this is a quick introduction. This is my transparency that tells us about the ESI model. So the ESI model, for me, is a mathematical concept. Let me just move quickly to the mathematics. The ESI model, you take a lump of iron, stick it in a magnetic field, increase the field, so this is the field, increasing field here, this is magnetization, increase the magnetization in the lump of iron goes up, decrease the field, the magnetization goes down, but it doesn't always go back to zero, sometimes it goes back to some residual magnetization which survives, and whether it goes back to zero or not depends upon the temperature. So high temperature means you go back to zero, there's a lot of internal disorder. Low temperature, there's less internal disorder, the effect of the external field is remembered, and so we get this hysteretic effect at low temperature, and there is a critical temperature, and the temperature is called the Curie point, and this one is Pierre, not Marie. And as pointed out in the French literature just a couple of years ago, it's actually not the Curie point, it should be called the Pouillet point, because Pouillet discovered it 63 years ahead of Marie, of Pierre Curie. But at least it's French, so we don't have to worry at night about ascribing it to a different nationality. Well, maybe we do. Maybe the Russians discovered it in 1812. I don't know. So what's the mathematical model? So Lenz, the story is that Lenz gave this, the one-dimensional model to Ising for his thesis work in 1925, and Ising did some work on the one-dimensional model. So, of course, as Alan Sokol says, this should be called the Lenz model, not the Ising model, just as he's fond of saying the Potts model should be called the Dom model, not the Potts model. And so Lenz proposed this model to Ising. In two dimensions, then, we think about the lump of iron as being a grid, a rectangular grid in this case, but it doesn't have to be rectangular. Each point in that grid is an item which has two possible states, a spin up or a spin down, a plus or minus, a zero or one. And there's a probability mesh, so we've got a lattice. So the sample space, so you can see I'm a probabilist, that's a set of all possible configurations, is the set of all vectors of zero, of pluses and minuses indexed by the points of the lattice. Easy. What's the measure? So the measure, the probability measure, is the following guy here. So the probability you see a configuration sigma is basically the Gibbs formula, it's e to the minus reciprocal temperature times the Hamiltonian, the energy contained in the configuration sigma. So that's a general formula, of course. What is the Hamiltonian? The Hamiltonian is the sum over all neighbors of the product of the spins. That's the internal interaction. minus the sum over all points of the single spin. So this is the external field. So H is the external field, J is the internal interaction. So J measures the degree to which vertices like to be like each other or unlike each other, depending on the sign of J, and H measures the external imposition of an external of a field. And we are only going to set H to zero, actually, and what I'm going to do, we're going to consider how J varies, and my J is always going to be positive, which means this is ferromagnetic, which means that things like to be like their neighbours. If I'm plus, I get extra probability through my neighbours being plus, or more likely to be plus than minus. Whereas the anti-ferromagnetic model, pluses like to be surrounded by minuses and vice versa, and that's much harder because descent is a much higher dimensional space than ascent. So two more generalized transparencies. So this is the sort of the whole of the EC model in three transparencies. Well, not really the beginning. So let's take H to be zero, plus boundary condition. So fix the boundary condition. That's a way of imposing external field. So I look at a box, fix pluses around the outside. So the pluses like pluses. So the pluses tend, probabilistically, to invade this box. So inside, there's a bias towards plus because plus is being forced upon the box. So how do you represent that, of course, by a probability measure with a boundary condition? So this is exactly the same formula as before, only it's the formula conditioned upon having plus all the way around the boundary. So that's what this formula means. So this guy up here, this plus, just means the boundary condition. And, of course, there are a variety of other boundary conditions, but plus is the boundary condition which we will work with mostly. Now, remember, with plus boundary conditions, there's a bias towards plus. That's what plus boundary conditions with positive J means. So a way of measuring that bias is to say, I've got this big box, I've got pluses around the outside, what's the probability I see plus at the middle? That's this guy here. What's the probability at the origin the spin is plus? Now, if I had no boundary conditions, everything is plus minus symmetric, so the probability of having plus at the middle must be the same as probability of having minus. Probability sum to 1, so it must be a half. So subtract off the unbiased quantity. So this is the residual effect of having pluses on the boundary of a box lambda. The question now is, as lambda becomes very big, as we go to the thermodynamic limit, as lambda passes to the whole space, is this plus boundary condition remembered or not at the center? So we want to pass to the limit. And so the first theorem says that limit exists. That requires a proof. And I'll talk about proofs in a moment. But I'm a mathematician. I want to prove it. That's my inclination, so that's what I do, and that's what you're here for the next half hour. Now, think about that function is it's also monotonic in beta. So beta's what? Beta measures somehow the strength of interactions. Beta is reciprocal temperature. I don't like to call it inverse temperature because that assumes you've decided what group you're working in. That's just a sort of personal thing. So it's 1 over temperature. So that's monotone in beta. The question is, when is this zero, of course? This has a limit. When is it zero? It's certainly non-negative. And the theorem says that there is a critical point above which it's strictly positive, beneath which it's zero. And that point, of course, is the 1 over the Curie temperature. We want to understand this process. So that's the Ising model in a nutshell. The questions already that we've identified here, which are long solved, are, okay, so you can formulate this guy. How can you prove the limit exists? How can you prove that M is monotone in beta? How can you understand the behavior near this critical point? Is this critical point non-trivial? How do you understand the behavior near the critical point? How does that behavior depend on the number of dimensions or the assumptions that you made about the lattice or about the interaction? So here are some issues associated with the EC model. First question, which naively one asks, is what is the critical point? What is the numerical value of the critical point? And the rough answer to that is you have no chance of answering that question except in two dimensions where you might have some special properties, which might tell you, such as duality, which might tell you what that should be. It's a live issue. Once you've identified a critical point, you have a subcritical regime and a supercritical regime. It divides the parameter space into two regimes. What are their natures? What do they look like? What are the clusters of pluses? What's a typical configuration look like in those two phases? When you're at the critical point, what happens? Of course, there's a phase transition, so there's some polynomial behavior going on, some polynomial discontinuity. What can you say about the powers of the critical exponents? What can you say about scaling theory? when you look at a configuration, you're not just computing functions, you're actually looking at a whole configuration, so you can ask about the geometry of that configuration. So this is a question, this is closely allied, for a very good example of this, of course, is what can you say about the wolf shape? So the wolf problem is a standard problem that goes back to Wolf's 1901 paper in the Zeitschrift für Kristallographie, is that right? Where Wolf postulates that in a wide variety of settings, when shapes grow, they grow in such a way as to minimize energy on the surface. So what is the wolf problem here? It's a geometrical question. What is the geometrical question in the context of the Ising model, and can we solve it? And the answer is, to a degree, yes. And of course, what is the dependence on dimension? Two dimensions is always very special. High dimensions is always special because we have other arguments for high dimensions based upon lace expansion techniques. So there is a dimension dependence. Can we fill in the gap between the special nature of two dimensions and the high dimensional theorems? So it usually turns out that the most interesting case is d equals 3. And if you can solve a problem for d equals 3, you can, well, shouldn't make such a blanket statement, but 3 is a good place to start. That's probably a good place to finish. Now, of course, we can go beyond this ferromagnetic Ising model. We can consider the anti-ferromagnetic Ising model, which is much more complex. It depends much more upon the structure of the graph. A bipartite graph, for example, can be partitioned into two sets of vertices. By switching the pluses and minuses on one of those sets, you can map anti-ferromagnetic to ferromagnetic models. But many lattices, many graphs are not bipartite, so one can't use that technique in general. What can we say about the anti-ferromagnet? How about disordered Ising models? We've got these J's. Each pair has got a J sitting on it. Imagine that those J's were not constant. Imagine those J's sampled according to a probability distribution. So we have a random environment of interactions. What can we then say about the Ising model? What if that random environment were of such a state that certain configurations were not allowed? So this is a spin glass problem. So the Ising model is the starting point for what you might call greater Ising. Many beautiful problems. The quantum Ising model I'm going to talk about later. So the quantum Ising model is inspired by the Ising model. I don't know where it goes back to, but certainly it goes back to the famous paper of Lieb, Schultz, and Matisse in the 60s, maybe early 70s, I'm not sure. 60s, thank you. And then, of course, there is beyond Ising. Ising has two spins. What about Q-spins? That's the Potts model. Great parallels between Ising and the Potts model, but somehow for Ising, one could do lots of things that one can't do for Potts. Why is that? Well, it boils down to the fact that 2 is a special number. 2 is special, 3 is, of course, special, but special in a different way. And the 2 has certain very special properties which lead to techniques which seem to work for Ising that nobody can yet work for Potts. There are many beautiful exact solutions for the Potts model and for the Ising model. Of course, the best exposition of these probably is still the very beautiful book of Rodney Baxter. Many of these exact solutions are, of course, unproven, as Baxter is fully aware. These are exact results. They are not rigorous results. And part of the challenge to mathematicians is to make them rigorous or to understand where the problems lie. And, of course, to add to them by devising theory which complements and helps build rather than merely cleans up after the physicist's intuition. And, of course, there are many other spin models which are related to the Ising model. Furthermore, we could add dynamics. This is a static system. There's no time. We could have an Ising model where, as time passes, the configuration changes. The stochastic Ising model are many ways of doing that, and this leads to a very beautiful theory. So that's where the Ising model goes to, or might go to. There are different ways of approaching the Ising model, and I'm going to concentrate in the remainder of this talk on one particular method of approach, which is the fourth of my listed on this transparency. So the first is, you might say, by exact calculation. So it's quite common in this area. You hear the statement say, oh, that was just proved by Onsager. Now, as McCoy and Wu have pointed out, that's a pretty dangerous statement. To make these exact computations that go back to this very beautiful work, to turn them into mathematics which we can understand and export to other areas and which satisfies levels of rigor in order to satisfy constipated individuals such as myself, a great deal of work has to be done. And much of that work has not yet been done. Then the usual way among statistical physicists of approaching these systems is via correlation inequalities. Correlation inequalities always have 2 or 3 initials associated with them. It's no longer necessarily important to know what the initials mean, but GHS is a very good acronym, This is actually Griffith, Hurst, and Sherman. So there are bunches of correlation inequalities which enable one to understand monotonicities and hence existences of limits. So correlation inequalities, in a sense, come from trying to understand this classical view of statistical mechanics, which is to try to understand things through the partition function. You look at the partition function, you look at its derivatives, and you try to understand how things are related to each other through the partition function. There's a probabilistic approach also, and there are two particular techniques that work well in the Ising case. One is what we might call the random current method. So this is a method that goes back to Griffith, if not before, but was used very beautifully and visibly by Simon and Leib in the early 80s, and particularly beautifully by Michael Eisenman and his co-authors. And the random current method is not something which I'm going to tell you about today, but it really works because 2 is 1 plus 1. It really works because you look at a graph and you turn the Ising model into a system where you have to count configurations of a certain sort. And the configurations you have to count are related to flow, non-zero flows, the number of non-zero flows of a certain characteristic. And when they're non-zero flows of size 2, you're doing arithmetic modulo 2, and the only non-zero number modulo 2 is 1, and for the Ising model. And because of that fact, the random current representation for the Ising model turns into something which can be worked with. So there is a random current representation of the Potts model, but because non-zero flows mod q are rather more complicated than mod 0 flows mod 2, we don't know how to do it. So it's a very good problem to make, to extend that method to the Potts model. The Ising model, it's yielded all sorts of really beautiful theorems which have completely answered many of the questions. So in some sense, a tightly defined bunch of problems have been completely answered for the Ising model, except in 3 dimensions. They work up 2 dimensions, special arguments. They work above, I forget, is it 10 over 3 dimensions, if you sort of fractionalize the argument, but they don't work at 3 dimensions. So still in 3 dimensions, the nice thing about this area is, however much you do, there's always a good problem. There's always a good problem just over the horizon. And the method I want to concentrate on in this talk is the random cluster model. This is because I've been thinking a lot about the random cluster model since I came to Cambridge, actually. When I came to Cambridge in 92, I thought, what sort of big project should we do next? Why not take percolation techniques and export them into this domain? And the way to do that is via the random cluster model. So I've been thinking deeply about that, so I've discovered lots of problems and solved a few of them. But before I tell you about the random cluster model, let me just tell you quickly about the Potts model. So the Potts model was proposed by Dom to Potts. It's a model which has 2 or more states. So here we go through exactly the same formalism as before. Each vertex is now in one of Q states. Q is, of course, an integer, at least 2. The formula, the Gibbs formula, the Hamiltonian is what now? So the Hamiltonian is exactly the same as we had before, only instead of the product of the spins on an edge, we have a delta function, a Kronecker delta. And the Kronecker delta says, look at the edge, look at the spins at the ends of that edge. If those spins are the same, score 1. If they're different, score 0. So the Potts model only recognizes whether spins are the same or different. There are other models which recognize in what way they would be different, but this is a particularly interesting and simple model which seems to extend the Ising model correctly. So the Potts model extends the Ising model, and I just want to draw that to your attention before I move to the random cluster model. So let's go straight to random cluster, and I'll tell you a little bit about the history. So here's a graph, a general graph. What I have done is I've lost my watch. Oh, it's on the other side of it. Thank you very much. Thank you. So start with a general graph. Please go ahead.
There is the usual, every model has Gibbs measure, Hamiltonian, so configuration, plus minus 1. What is actually a problem? Minimization of the Hamiltonian or what?
No, this is not a ground state problem. I regard this as a probabilistic problem. You look at a configuration on a box, each configuration has got different probabilities. Yep. You pass to a limit. You pass to the thermodynamic limit, and what you see is what we call a random field, a collection of pluses and minuses. And the basic question is to understand the geometry of that configuration. So what you need to do, of course, is identify the right questions and then find out the right way of answering those questions. And the starting point of the analysis which I espouse is that this is a problem in probability theory, and we need to bring the language of probability theory in to understand this question. Of course, many of these questions can be phrased as analytical questions involving the partition function. But my hypothesis is that for many of the very natural questions, such as the Wolf construction, this is not the right way to formulate the question, and therefore not the right way to answer the question.
This illustrates what you said, right? There is no concise, clear, even statement of the problem.
I didn't fully understand the beginning of your sentence, so I didn't grasp a complete, concise question either, but I'm perfectly happy to have a go if you want to say it again.
You have a quote in the beginning of your talk that the whole area is a bit vague, right, in the sense that statements and even precise rigorous formulations for the problem, right?
Is my formulation not rigorous and precise? I think one of the problems is perhaps that my formulation is rigorous and precise. But I might be wrong. So here is a graph, an arbitrary graph, and for each edge, we flip a coin. The coin comes up heads with probability P, otherwise it comes up tails. There are two possibilities. When I flip a coin for this edge, it comes up heads, and so I put a 1 down there. When it comes up tails, I put a 0. So this is what you might call a random graph. Edges are present independently of each other at random. That independence is very important and leads to a beautiful structure which is largely understood for many graphs. If this graph were a lattice, this would be called the Bohm percolation model. So the outcome is a set of edges with 1 sitting there. That we might think of those as the good edges. We throw away the bad edges. We left only with those edges which are labeled 1, the edges where the coin came up heads. And the basic question is, what is the structure of that graph? What can you say about what that graph looks like? And two particular examples then, the Erdős-Reni random graph and the percolation model for different, very different types of graph, the complete graph and the lattice.
Jeffrey, you said something about a P coin. I didn't catch that.
This is a coin. Thank you, Brian. This is a coin that comes up heads with probability P. So I have a special coin in my pocket. In fact, I've got a continuum of coins in my pocket. You tell me the value of P and I will choose the one that comes. Thank you, Brian. So this is a way of writing down the probability measure associated with that. This is just product measure. It says that the probability, so little p is the parameter of this probability measure. The probability you see a configuration is a configuration of zeros and ones. So whenever the configuration on an edge E is 1, you score p. Whenever it's 0, you score 1 minus p. So the probability of a configuration is p to the number of ones, 1 minus p to the number of zeros. So this is just the way of writing down that product measure in terms of probability theory. Now, the random cluster model mucks that up. It takes that probability measure here, and it changes it. So we might call it by introducing a Radon-Nikodym derivative. That would be a fancy way of saying that we take that probability measure and we multiply by something which depends upon the configuration, and we obtain, therefore, something which doesn't add up to 1, so we have to renormalize it to make it a probability measure. And that object there is Q. A Q is some parameter. Q, I'm fond of saying, is not necessarily 1 minus P, but it could be. Q is what you count, the exponent here, is the number of clusters in this graph. So you take the original graph, take a configuration of zeros and ones, just keep the ones, that's this graph. How many clusters do you have? How many connected components? 1, 2, 3 connected components. So I call that K of omega. Don't forget the isolated vertices, otherwise everything goes wrong. So there are 3 of them here. K of omega is 3. So this, the weighting factor here would be Q to the power 3. Sorry, Lilangela.
Does the word open have a particular significance there?
Oh, open just means what? Oh, physical significance. Well,
no, not physical.
So the reason we use the words open and closed is because Hammersley, in his original paper in 1957, talked about the passage of fluid. His model was that he was modeling the passage of fluid or rumor or disease through a network. And so his idea was that these open edges were edges which were open, which were big enough to allow molecules of fluid to pass down them, as opposed to edges which were closed, which were impassable to whatever the material was.
So my question is, are you only counting clusters which have...
Yes.
Are you only counting clusters which don't have loops or are not closed?
An edge is either open or closed. Loops are not part of this discussion. An edge is either open or closed, so it could be that in this graph, there is a loop. I wouldn't mind. That's still only one cluster. I want to count the number of clusters, the number of connected components. So this is a perfectly honest probability measure. When Q is 1, it's the same as what I had to start with. Okay. This probability measure was formulated by these two chaps in the late 60s, 1969, 1970. This is Pete Castellane in a photograph taken in 1968. And this is his PhD student, Case Faltein, in a photograph that appeared in his Californian driver's license in 1971. It's the only photograph that Faltein has of that time, apparently. So some technological work, some technical work was necessary to turn his Californian driver's license into a reproducible photograph. You wouldn't recognize him. He's had his hair cut off since. So it's a very bad likeness in a sense. But these two chaps came up with this idea. And they came up with this idea because Castellane, what Castellane wanted to do was he observed that a variety of different systems have series parallel laws. Electrical resistances, that's the canonical situation where if you have two edges in series, you can replace them by a single edge with the right electrical resistance, the sum of the resistances. If you have two edges in parallel, you can replace them by a single edge of the right resistance, a series parallel law. He observed that this is also true in the Ising model, the Potts model, and in percolation. So you have to do the computations to check that. It's not completely obvious, but anybody who's worked with these things recognizes the circle of ideas. So what he wanted to see was whether the fact that these systems had series parallel laws meant anything, whether it could lead to any beautiful mathematics. And the answer is yes. It's because all those systems, electrical networks, percolation, Ising pots, in some sense are contained within that probability measure that I wrote on the previous sheet. There are two parameters in that measure, P and Q. Q is exactly the number of states in the Potts model, and P is related to beta, the inverse temperature. And a certain amount of work is necessary to do that, and essentially that work is contained on this transparency, though when Faltein and Castellane wrote it up, it was rather opaque. But this transparency doesn't contain proofs. So this transparency addresses itself just to one particular question. If I've got the random cluster model, that's a realization from that probability measure, how do I get to a Potts model? What's ticking? What's the mechanism that's going on here? So I take a random cluster measure. It's got two parameters, P and Q. And I'm going to insist that Q is an integer at least 2. The model exists for other values of Q, but for Q, an integer at least 2, this correspondence works. So Q is such an integer. P, I'm transforming P to another quantity, which I'm going to happen to call beta J. They're married together. It's beta times J. But we recognize those as the constant in a Potts model. So what I do is now I sample my open graph according to the random cluster model. So that means that I've got a probability measure in terms of P and Q. I sample from that whatever. It's not necessarily easy to sample from that. I mean, you might have to. You'd have to think about how you'd write a computer program to do that, but you can do it. And then you see a picture, and that's a random graph. Those are the open components in this random graph. This is the probability measure, the random cluster measure with parameters P and Q. Now, we do something. The Potts model, remember, has got spins on vertices. It doesn't see open closed edges. It's a vertex model, not an edge model. So I've got to do something. So what I do is I look at each of these clusters and I flip a coin. Now, this is a Q coin, but it's different. It's a different type of coin. It's a coin that has Q possible outcomes with equal probability. So this is a coin with Q faces. And when you flip it, it comes up with one face. Each face has probability 1 over Q of coming up. So I look at this cluster, and I flip my Q coin, and out of this coin flips, and I see, and the face showing on the coin shows a number between 1 and Q, and I write that number down on all the vertices on this cluster. I allocate that spin to all vertices in the cluster. Now I come to another cluster, and I spin the same Q coin, but I spin it again. I've got to spin it again. And I get another number, perhaps, or maybe the same, which I write down on this cluster. And I do that to all those clusters. So I put spins down, which are constant on clusters and independent between clusters. It's a very simple probabilistic operation. And the answer is, so then I see spins everywhere. I see numbers between 1 and Q. I throw away the redness, so I don't see which edges are red or not red. I just retain those spin values. And the theorem says that spin configuration is a Potts configuration with beta J and Q as its parameters.
What with free boundary conditions?
There is no assumption here in boundary conditions. Any boundary condition that can be mapped into a connectivity relation for a graph this will work for. So it'll work for Debruchian boundary conditions. It'll work for mixed boundary conditions. But there are, well, for Debruchian boundary conditions, you have to be careful, because a Debruchian boundary condition, which I probably won't mention later because there won't be time, says you put one spin here and another spin here, and they're different spins. Now, in the random cluster situation, that corresponds to one set of vertices being connected, but there being no path between the two. So the corresponding Debruchian method of constructing this, so I hope you don't mind, I'm jumping to the answer of a question which has not been posed completely or correctly, but I think I know what the question is, would be to do the same thing, but to condition upon there being no path from one set of vertices to the other. So one would require a slight extra an elaboration of this in order to construct Debruchian boundary conditions. But this model, this general relationship, is the one to hold on to. So the result of this is that if two things are in the same cluster, they receive the same spin.
And the same construction works as the external field.
Yes, absolutely. So then one would assume the existence of a new vertex, which you call the ghost or the whatever you want to call it. And this is a vertex which is always, say, in the plus state. And when it's connected to vertices, it forces them into the plus state. And the parameter on that edge would depend upon the strength of the external field. So there is another elaboration which enables you to impose external field. Now, so the point here is that if things are in the same cluster, they get the same spin. So if there's a big cluster, then you see the same spin in a systematic way across the graph, however big the graph. So the existence of large clusters gives you long-range correlations. So the big picture is that the geometry of the random cluster model tells you about the correlations of the Potts model. And since correlations are what makes the Potts model tick in classical terms, many, but not all of these questions involving correlations can be turned into questions of geometry for the random cluster model. And this is the main result here, which is known, of course, to FK. It says in any graph, if you want to know the chance that two vertices have got the same spin, that's the same up to constants of the probability in the random cluster model that there is a path from X to Y. So the existence of a path, well, not the existence, that's an event. The probability of a path is essentially the same as the probability two vertices have the same spin. So two-point correlation functions map into probabilities. So if X and Y are a long way apart, this is essentially the two-point correlation function of the Potts model, that is the same as the probability of a large cluster containing those two vertices. So the idea is to use percolation-type technology to understand stochastic geometry in this setting in order to understand the way the Potts model works. So that picture makes sense, and a lot of success has come from that world viewpoint.
Can I ask a question?
Please do.
This picture can be related to the Parallels contour, if I understand.
Yes. Is that a statement or a question?
It's a question.
I missed the question. Oh, can it be? Yes.
Yes. Can it be related to the Parallels contour?
Yes. So counting Pyle's contours for the Ising model, it is arguably the case, because it can be done very well for the Ising model, that it is in a way more natural to do it for the random cluster model. So these arguments involving counting Pyle's clusters or understanding their geometry have an exact counterpart for the random cluster model. The questions are slightly different. And the reason is because in Pyle's contours surround, for example, spins of the same state. Now, in the random cluster model, you can accumulate spins of the same state in two ways. You either because the vertices are in the same cluster, when they automatically get the same state, or it could be that you have two abutting clusters which by chance get the same spin. In which case, the Ising spin Pyle's cluster will go around the entire outside of those two, the union of those two clusters, but the random cluster Pyle's contour will go around them separately. So that it's not quite the same question, and the techniques that you need to understand to be able to compute and count Pyle's clusters are slightly different because the geometrical questions are slightly different. So I happen to feel that the neater way of studying Pyle's clusters is via the random cluster model rather than via the classical way that Pyle's introduced. But that's perhaps a personal point of view. I think it's partly justified by a statement which I was going to make later, but let me make it now, which is that One of the areas which has attracted a lot of attention for the Easing and Potts model is a two-dimensional situation, in fact, particularly what happens at and near the critical point. So the question would be, at and near the critical point in a Potts model, what do, or an Easing model, let's stick to Easing, what do the piles contours look like? Because there may be some very large plus clusters, and therefore some very large piles contours. And if we rescale the space, what can we say about the geometry of these piles contours as space shrinks in some, you know, as epsilon goes to zero, if you're living on a lattice of spatial scale epsilon. Now, for the Easing, for the percolation model, we now understand about this. I mean, there's a theorem, and it's due to Smirnov, and it's tied to work of Schramm, Lawler, and Werner, that says that certain interfaces in percolation converge to these stochastic Loebner evolutions with a certain parameter, and we can study them, we can write down these, we can do the stochastic analysis associated with these SLEs, and out of that comes precise theorems about critical exponents, about Hausdorff dimension of paths, about what they look like and how they're generated. So one of the big challenges is to do the same for the Easing model, and we're in the process now of seeing that emerge from the work of Smirnov, which is not yet published. So Smirnov has ways now of extending his work for percolation, which was to prove the discrete limit, you know, the epsilon goes to zero limit of these interfaces for percolation to SLE6. And he has now ways of doing comparable things for the Easing model. So and it turns out that the way to do it in the Easing model for him is to do it via the random cluster representation of the Easing model, the Q equals 2 version of this random cluster model. So essentially, in some sense, what he's doing is he's studying the geometry of large piles contours for the Q equals 2, D equals 2 random cluster model. And then from that calculation, there's a parallel calculation. It's not that they live together. I think it's wrong to say one lives off the back of the other. But in parallel to that comes corresponding SLE statements about the piles contours, the large piles contours of the two-dimensional Easing model. And the values of kappa, the parameter values, are understood and come out in the computations. And so there are 3 papers of Smirnov due to appear, one of which is now being circulated. You look as if you're pregnant with a question, Yuri. No, curiously enough, his work in the Easing model is on the square lattice. Very, very curious. So there is no three-way symmetry. So it's a different operation, and it's going to be the source of much curiosity, the target of much curiosity. So to go back to the elementary, we're discussing here the phase transition. So the phase transition in the Potts model. So remember, in the Potts model, what we were interested in, we've got this big box, we're interested in, with plus boundary conditions, what is the probability that the origin is the origin has the same spin as the boundary? The boundary is plus, what's the probability the origin also has spin plus? So the random cluster representation, that's this guy here. The random cluster model tells me that that is the same as, in the random cluster measure, where I've done something to the boundary, that there is a path from the origin to the boundary. So as lambda fills out space, that path becomes an infinite path, and we become interested in this probability, which is essentially the two-point correlation function of the Potts model, which says, in the random cluster measure, which corresponds to plus boundary conditions, we call that the wired random cluster measure, what is the probability that the origin lies in an infinite path, is connected to points lying infinitely far away? So this is an honest probability. We call it theta. It's a function of the parameters P and Q. Remember, Q corresponds morally to the number of states in the Potts model. P corresponds morally to the inverse temperature. And as before, for any fixed Q, there is a phase transition. The phase transition says that there is a critical value of P, which corresponds to the Curie point, beneath which this is zero. That means that the truncated two-point correlation function is zero. There's no long-range order, above which there is long-range order. And so this is these are the two pictures that could occur, the blue picture or the red picture. And the next question, of course, is, so we understand that this point exists. This is related to the Curie point in the usual way. And the question is it the red picture or is it the blue picture? Is there a continuous phase transition or a discontinuous phase transition? So this is a question that comes from the Potts model but exists in all random cluster measures. And we don't know the answer to this. We don't know in general whether these graphs are continuous or discontinuous at the critical point. So there's a great deal of information, a partial information about that, but the fundamental question that this picture poses is, under what conditions is the phase transition continuous, and under what conditions is it discontinuous? So let me just state a couple of problems. I've described a sort of general approach. Let me tell you one problem to which we don't know the answer. So take a random cluster measure with parameter q bigger than or equal to 1, so it's a bit Pottsian, if you like. Q less than 1 is a bit different. It doesn't satisfy the same correlation type inequalities. So q less than 1, q bigger than 1 is a pivot. P less than PC, so you're subcritical. So this is the Potts model, morally, with no long-range order. It should be the case, then, that, every physicist knows that if you're in the subcritical regime of a Potts model, the two-point correlation function decays exponentially. There's no proof of that. In the random cluster setting, it corresponds to this conjecture, that if you're subcritical, the chance of a path joining 0 and x decays exponentially in the distance between 0 and x. There's no proof of that. So it's a very, very basic question. This is the question that was solved in the percolation regime by Eisenman, Barsky, and independently by Menshikov in 1985, 6, 7, and acquired much acclaim at the time. But this is not solved for the general Potts model, for the general random cluster model, or for the general Potts model, actually. So we know quite a lot about it. So this, you know, one grinds away at these problems. If P is sufficiently small, it's okay. That's comparison. I mean, often it's true. You know, you find something for high temperature or low temperature. The problem is to make it work in some intrinsic way right up to the critical temperature. We don't know how to do that. It's true if Q is large. Well, this is a bit sort of Pilesian. This is pure Rossini. This is polymer representations. Things that come out of statistical physics, arguments that come out of statistical physics that can be applied here, say basically you can do everything you like so long as something is small or 1 over it is large, and Q in this case is the chap in question. So if Q is large, we can do all this and more. Q equals 2, we can do it. Now, why is that? That's because 2 is 1 plus 1, because the random current representation, Eisenman, Fernandez, Barsky, comes into play, and this is then one of the problems that we can solve using their techniques, and so we get exponential decay. So this is a very good example of a problem to which we have very convincing partial statements, but we have no complete solution. People do not doubt its truth. Please.
You invert your conjecture, and you say, okay, I'm filling up the space with probability with correlation function which is exponentially decreasing with the distance. This one cannot prove that in that case in two dimensions you have a correlation. Is there some?
Do you mean the opposite?
The highest conjecture. Is it conjecture or is it a statement?
I'm not quite sure I understood your question. So are you saying that if you have a general model with an exponential decay of two-point correlation function, which in my case is connection, can you disprove the existence of percolation?
Right. Or prove? Or what are the conditions? What could you? How could you limit the behavior of the correlation function in a way which will either ensure or forbid a percolation?
It's a very interesting question, of course. So you refer to Harris. You mean Ted Harris, of course, these geometrical arguments of Ted Harris.
Yes.
Yeah, Harris is... Most of these arguments rely... You have to have something more. What you can do more depends a lot upon what you're prepared to assume on the model. And, of course, the sort of elementary things that a probabilist would depend upon the model are, for example, translation invariance, mirror invariance in lines, in three dimensions, mirror invariance in planes... some sort of reflection. Yes, that's the same as mirror. So there are certain operations on the graph which might or might not lead to invariances with respect to the probability measure. And under certain conditions on these invariances, one is able sometimes to show that if correlations decay, if connectivity decays sufficiently fast, then there will be no percolation. Or in the dual model, there will therefore be in two dimensions. In two dimensions, showing the absence of percolation in one model is often the same as showing the presence of percolation in the dual. So it is sometimes the case that if you make some assumptions on decay and you add together enough symmetries of the model, then this Harris-type argument about combining paths, building contours, the blocking contours, makes sense and can be done. We don't know how to do that, I think, in three dimensions. These arguments are two-dimensional.
So this is This is a statement which I want to prove. It's not only a heuristic argument.
No, there are theorems of that nature. I'd have to think very carefully. I've been very careful not to say, here is a theorem, because I'm not ready to state one. But these are arguments which have been explored and which are partially understood in two dimensions. But in two dimensions is much easier. Once again, it's because 1 plus 1 is 2, but this is for a different reason. This is because the codimension of a line in two dimensions is 1, so you block clusters by building fences, which are topologically one-dimensional. Whereas in three dimensions, you block clusters by building fences which are topologically two-dimensional. Well, it's more complex than that, of course, in two dimensions. And that's a much harder system, and we don't know how to deal with that problem. But in two dimensions, these arguments, you can make sense of these arguments. There are other situations in which you can... Any situation, for example, where you have what you might call a Simon-Leib inequality. So there are also arguments that say that in certain situations... If the chance of being joined to the surface of a large box is sufficiently small, which corresponds, which is a consequence of exponential decay of correlations, then by some iterative, you might say, renormalizing block argument, you can show that this is true on all scales. So there are also arguments of that sort, which I think of as kind of Judah, Hammersley, and Simon and Leib. So, yes, bunch of ways to answer that question. So I put up one transparency about to confirm this question about continuity or discontinuity. So fix the number of dimensions. Fix the graph you're going to work on. You have a P, you have a Q. Morally, what happens is that when Q is small, supposing Q is 1, that's the smallest value of Q we'd like to study in this context, then everything should be well behaved, and we believe that that there is no discontinuity in the phase transition, that it's a second order phase transition, that the theta function is continuous as you pass through the critical point. There is a theorem. The theorem is due to, probably Kotecky-Schlossman, but depending on which bit of the theorem one wants to quote, but probably this goes back to Kotecky-Schlossman, but it's made more complete in the random cluster setting by Lanaet, Messager, Miracle Soleil, Ruiz, and Schlossman. Which says that if Q is large, you have a discontinuous phase transition. If Q is large, you have discontinuity. So it's true then that this percolation probability, this residual magnetization, is certainly zero at the critical point. Well, I take that back. It's certainly strictly positive at the critical point, which corresponds to a discontinuity if Q is large. The conjecture is that it's equal to zero if Q is small. And the second conjecture is that there is a sharp cutoff in Q between these two values. In other words, as you increase Q, when you're smaller than some value of Q, capital Q, say, you have a smooth phase transition above which you have a discontinuous phase transition. Now, I've always wondered whether... So part of this conjecture is just a statement about monotonicity. It says somehow, as you increase Q, the discontinuity grows. It sits at zero for a while, and as you get to a larger value Q, it starts becoming positive. And as Q gets larger, the size of the discontinuity grows. So this is a monotonicity statement. It should be possible, since it's a pure monotonicity statement, to prove it by some sort of elementary mechanism. So what we need is a monotonic function. So think about this as a function of Q. Is it a monotonic function of Q? The problem, of course, is that Q occurs twice in this statement. As Q changes, this Q may be fine, but Q is also changing the point to the value of P at which you're working. So to prove this is monotonic, my guess is it's monotonic, but I don't know any method of showing that it's a monotonic function of Q. That leads to a kind of generic question, which I've always been very fond of, which is the following. In all your experience, there is a theorem of some sort that says F is a monotonic function. Do you know any theorem that says f is a monotonic function for which the proof is essentially non-trivial? The answer, of course, is yes. But you see, in statistical mechanics and probability theory, if a function is monotonic, it usually has a trivial proof. For example, for percolation, is a very good example, consider that percolation probability is a function of p. P is the intensity of edges being present. That function is a monotonic function of P. And the reason it's monotonic for the probabilist is because you can couple all these things together in a certain probabilistic way to show that pathwise, with respect to configurations, as you increase P, you're actually making the configuration physically bigger. So there's a trivial probabilistic proof that that function is monotonic. So here, is there, if we don't have a trivial proof, then will we ever prove it? Now, you're stopping me, so let me just jump to the end of my talk, because I did want to talk about, you see, this is really two talks. I did want to talk about the quantum easing model. So if you could allow me 3 minutes to talk about the quantum easing model. You have, oh, that's what the question, maybe I'll answer your question then without the question, but let me answer it first in case I can't answer your question. So I just wanted to show you, this is recent work with Tobias Osborne and Petra Skuda on the quantum Ising model. At first sight, this looks like nothing like what we've talked about before, except that the equations look a bit similar, but it turns out to be exactly the same as what I've been talking about so far. So this is the one-dimensional quantum Ising model, so shift gear for the moment. Just, we've got n plus one points. The Hamiltonian is given by this formula. This is one-dimensional. These are Pauli operators. So these are the Pauli operators at x and x plus 1. So we take the product of those operators, the product over neighbors in this one-dimensional set, and there's a sort of external field that's preferring the first Pauli operator over the third, whereas the interactions somehow prefer the third Pauli operator. Now, if you're asking me about the physics of this, the answer is I'll just say you've got to look it up in the literature, because I can hardly spell quantum. So all I know is that it's a Hamiltonian, and that there are people in the room who will understand what that means. And what we do with that Hamiltonian is we turn it into an operator by exponentiating where beta is, of course, as before, the inverse temperature. This turns into an operator on the appropriate Hilbert space, which we normalize by its trace. And so we have three parameters, a parameter lambda, which is a strength of interaction between neighbors, an external field delta, and an inverse temperature beta. But what we're interested in here is the ground state as beta goes to infinity, as the temperature goes to zero. Okay. And what's the problem? The problem that we're going to study here is how do we quantify the concept of entanglement in terms of beta, lambda, and delta. So what is entanglement? So here's a formulation of entanglement. So we take a collection of vertices, L plus 1 vertices in the middle, and we're going to ask, how are these vertices entangled with the rest? So a way of doing that, I'm told, is we had originally this operator rho m, which was, rho m is the operator associated with this entire set of vertices. And what we do is, I understand that trace is a verb, we trace that over a complete set of spins for the other vertices. You've got to learn the lingo, you know, in this game. So this says we trace rho m over the spins associated with the complement of this interval naught l. So we sum over the spins representing the spaces of the other vertices, and that gives me a reduced operator. And now we compute the entropy.
It's a matrix.
Am I saying the wrong thing?
It's a matrix.
It's a matrix, not an operator. Oh, I'm so sorry. I thought matrix was an operator. No, I thought an operator is not necessarily a matrix. That's true. Well, I've been trying to read Battier on matrix theory, and I must say I think it's a very beautiful and refined area of mathematics, which will probably be forever closed for to me now. Anyway, so it's a matrix. I apologize. Is this okay? This is an entropy. Is that right? Okay, so this is the entropy of this operator. And the question is...
Von Neumann.
Landau. I'm sorry? Landau. Oh, now we're going to have a fight. okay, so we've got this guy, and we want to understand how does it behave, and of course it's a matrix. Is it a matrix or is it an operator? Right, it's a matrix. So here is the basic theorem. So the theorem says, so L, remember, is fixed. It's the number of spins whose entanglement we wish to estimate. You must give me a lesson on the language, by the way, Yuri, afterwards. And the basic theorem tells us how the norm of this operator changes as M and N change, as we change the number of other points. Right. So the basic theorem says the following. Oh, I've got to have m here less than n. So this is for m less than n. So it says that there exist constants, depending on the parameters, c, lambda, and gamma, such that this difference can be bounded essentially exponentially above by the smaller of m and n, exponential function of the smaller of m and n. But there are some correction terms. The only way l occurs here is in this power. And from that theorem, according to some jiggery-pokery, which I've come to understand involving matrix theory, comes a logarithmic estimate on the on the entropy. And I'm told this is of some interest anyway. So the question is, how do we prove this? Now, so that's what my quantum theory colleagues tell me, that the sort of thing they want to prove. And to quote from a beautiful lecture of Martin Barlow, the resulting paper is the result of a negotiation. You know, the quantum theorists say, can you prove this? To which I say, no, it's wrong, but I could do this. To which they say, that's no good, could you prove this? So eventually, after a few weeks, this is an example of a convergent negotiation, and the convergent negotiation works because the quantum Ising model can be turned into the random cluster model. This was discovered by Eisenman, Klein, and Newman. I just want to show you this picture. It's a random cluster model with a difference. The random cluster model so far has been a model living on a discrete lattice. This is a model living on a lattice where it's z, the integers, cross the real line. So we have continuum lines, timelines. I call this space-time, space-time. What's the random cluster model? Well, we put down breaks in these timelines. We cut them up with a pair of scissors. We cut them up at the points of a Poisson process. We build bridges between these timelines. Where do we put them? At the points of a Poisson process. So we have some random realization of bridges and cuts according to Poisson processes. That's like the Erdős-Reni random graph. And now we change the measure. And I really am going to stop. This is the probability measure associated with these Poisson processes, and we muck it up by a power q to the number of clusters. Q is now 2. And so it turns out that this continuum random cluster model corresponds in a very precise way to this reduced density operator in the following very specific sense, that this object, which we might wish to calculate if we wish to calculate the norm of this operator, can be expressed completely precisely in terms of the ratio of two random cluster probabilities living on this configuration space, where the random cluster probabilities are given in terms of spins, sigma, and a function c, where c is precisely a representation of this vector psi in terms of the underlying basis of the Hilbert space. So this representation between the quantum Ising model and the continuum random cluster model takes us from a quantum model to a totally classical problem in probability theory. And by analyzing this completely classical problem, I mean, new problems arise, new questions arise, one needs new ideas, but by understanding this object, one can understand this object, hence back to the problem in the quantum Ising model, and I'm sorry, I've overrun slightly. Thank you.
One short question.
Well, I could make a short remark, and I hope it won't scare you off quantum theory, but in the early days of quantum theory, it was called matrix mechanics.
Two very frightening words.
Poisson process puzzles me. It seems, how did you come arrive at it? How did the Poisson process?
Yeah, so it's very striking, isn't it? It goes back actually to work. I believe Lieb, Schultz, and Mattis, I've never seen their paper, but I understand what they did was they took several models, and they, by adding a dimension, they relate these models to Ising models in, as it were, n plus one dimensions, but using some operator analysis. And this, much more recently in the 80s, there are papers of Campanino, Klein, and Perez who show how to map the quantum Ising model on ZD to a mixture of a type of classical Ising model on ZD cross Z. So they add an extra dimension, but the extra dimension is not equally spaced. It's in some limit as the spatial scale of that extra dimension is crushed to zero. And then my understanding of the literature is that Eisenman, Klein, and Newman realized that the right way to do this is actually via the continuum random cluster model. And quickly what you do is you take this operator, which is a function of beta, you've got e to the beta, and you express that as a sort of Lie formula. You break that up into beta over n, n copies of beta over n. You expand that. What do you call that? Oh, she knows that. Well, yeah, but I'm just testing. You know, the way to explain something is to find out whether you. Yeah, and then you represent. So we represent that geometrically by this is the time interval is of length beta. You break that time interval up into intervals. Does she know this too? So what's the question?
How the Poisson process comes in.
Sorry.
that's coming in. The extension to one extra dimension is something that...
Well, you just have to write down... You just have to write... I mean, this, it's a path integral. So you express everything as a path integral, and you look at the weights of different configurations, and then they say, oh, but that's just... You, because they're weights, they add up. You can normalize and add up to one. It's just the Poisson measure. Does that help?
Yes.